Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's great to have Chip Conley on the podcast. Chip is a New York Times bestselling author who helped Airbnb's founders turn their fast-growing tech startup into a global hospitality brand. In his book, Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder, he shares his unexpected journey at midlife, from CEO to intern, learning about technology as Airbnb's head of global hospitality and strategy, while also mentoring CEO Brian Chesky. This experience inspired the creation of the Modern Elder Academy, where a new roadmap for midlife is offered to help students unlock their wisdom and expand their potential at a beautiful oceanfront campus in Baja California Sur, Mexico. His other books include Emotional Equations, Peak, Marketing That Matters, and The Rebel Rules, Daring to Be Yourself in Business. Chip, it's awesome chatting with you today.
Yeah, Scott, thank you. It's an honor to be with you. I love your new book, and I feel like it's shocking that we haven't met until now.
Yeah, it is shocking, and a lot of people have recommended that I talk to you, so I'm so glad to finally get a chance to talk to you, and I'm glad I got the opportunity to read so much of your work because it's so interesting. You're such a fascinating guy. It's not just like the work you do. I mean, you are a fascinating human. Do you know that?
I don't know. Fascinating could be another way for saying bizarre or
no, it's my style.
Helen Keller, who basically was blind and deaf, and she said life is an adventure or nothing at all. And I do believe that. I believe that we're not here on earth to just get comfortable and apathetic.
I completely agree. And I know different people have different visions of the good life and what that means to them, but I've tried to embrace that. The good life is the full life and being fully human. And my gosh, you're still working towards being fully human and you're not even halfway done. So
work in progress. One of the things that's interesting about the word integrity, or just even whole, anything that's whole or integrity sort of speaks, it's always interesting to me because it's learning how to integrate the holes. You have all of these holes in your life, all these different elements of your life. And when you are able to integrate them, you are in the form of integrity. You're actually sort of integrating all of the components of you into the you that shows up wherever you are. It's interesting that the subtitle in my first book, more than 20 years ago, was called Daring to Be Yourself in Business. Because in many ways, 20 years ago, people felt like they had to leave their personality, their soul, their politics at the door when they walked in to the office. And I'm a big believer in the idea that, just showing up with who you are, pretty consistently in whatever habitat you're in, it serves you well and frankly builds a reputation of consistency.
I love that. And, some people might have different thoughts about authenticity and the importance of showing up. Some people argue that, there's some people that are so strategic about their authenticity all the time. I think it's called high self-monitors. I've never been a real high self-monitor. And I don't know, I always wonder sometimes, is that good or bad?
Well, that's a very good question. It depends on whether you're a politician. If you're running for office, you probably should have a high self-monitor.
Yeah, probably.
I'm watching House of Cards right now because that's what we do in a pandemic is we watch a lot of TV, and it's been like there's not a lot of high self-monitors among some of those people. but yeah, I think the challenge with, being selective about how you communicate and what level of candor you have is it's hard, especially as you get older, you sort of forget how much have I told these people about all of the components of my life. And it's a lot simpler to just be pretty candid throughout.
Yeah, it's simpler. It's the path of least resistance for sure of the self. But I want to jump into, let's start with 2013 and your work with Airbnb in mid-age. What was that experience like?
my background was I'd started a boutique hotel company called Joie de Vivre at age 26 and ran it for 24 years, created 52 boutique hotels, became the second largest boutique hotel here in the U.S. And then in the Great Recession, we just crashed. I mean, it was just a very big downturn, and I didn't want to do it anymore. And so after 24 years, I sold it, that company. Joie de Vivre is now part of Hyatt. But I wasn't really sure what was next for me, to be honest with you. There's a great movie, The Intern. It's, you know, never, not going to win an Academy Award, but people do actually get a chuckle and love it. And it was about Robert De Niro being the intern to Anne Hathaway, the young CEO. And as he was joining her, he said, musicians don't retire. They quit when there's no more music left inside of them. So I actually knew that I didn't want to quit. I was a musician in my own way. And I had music left inside of me, but I didn't know who to share it with. And I was approached by Brian Chesky, the co-founder and CEO. He asked if I wanted to help him democratize hospitality and be his in-house mentor. And I didn't know much about Airbnb. I'd gone from being the rebel boutique hotelier to being the establishment. And at age 52, I joined, but quickly learned that I was twice the age of the average employee, and I didn't know a darn thing about technology. And so I realized I was not just the mentor, but I was also the intern.
I love that. They could probably make a movie over your experience right there.
Yeah, you know, I think it was, what was really interesting about it, Scott, was there weren't a lot of models for me. The movie The Intern came out about 3 years after I started there, and it wasn't even exactly the right model, but it was, I had to learn along the way. I had to learn, like, how can I be as curious as I am wise? Because when it came to leadership skills and hospitality and emotional intelligence, I definitely had some wisdom to offer. But when it came to understanding millennial travel habits or Silicon Valley or just tech design and engineering and that lingo, man, I was out of my element. So I had to be comfortable that in some meetings I would be the dumbest person in the meeting, and other meetings I'd be the wisest. And I ultimately, that's what led the founders to calling me the modern elder at Airbnb, who is as curious as he is wise.
I love that. Curious as wise. That's similar to this mindset that you've proposed. Think younger and older at the same time. Mm-hmm. It makes me think of Maslow. I know he's a mutual friend of ours.
Yes.
So to speak, a friend we've never met. But, you know, he used to write about this kind of mind where you're a child, but you also have that wisdom, but you don't get rid of the child part of it. And so I love that you wrote about that mindset. I think more people should have that mindset as they grow older.
Well, I think there's a lot of great examples of that. Walt Disney was a really great example of that, of somebody who got wiser with time, but he never lost that sort of childlike innocence and sense of wonder. Peter Drucker, the management theorist, sort of had that as well. He had a practice in his last 25 years on the planet of every 2 years coming up with a new subject that had nothing to do with being a business professor that was intriguing to him, and he wanted to become the world's leading expert on that. So what it did is it was like that curiosity almost lubricates the mind, the heart, the spirit. And it turns out with Peter Drucker, he wrote, gosh, 2/3 of his 40 books after the age of 65.
Is that right? I didn't even know that. Wow. Go Drucker. How many more books do you think you have in you?
Good question. I don't know. I have no idea, Scott. I mean, it's a funny thing. I think being a writer and writing books is about being pregnant.
Yeah, it's so true.
It's, you're impregnated with some idea, and it's just growing inside of you, and you sort of can't ignore it. It's actually keeping you up at night. It's kicking you. And of course, you and I will never have that experience with a real child. But then there's this sense that you really need to nurture it and then birth it. And for me, other than the last book, Wisdom at Work, my prior 4 books all took approximately 9 months from the time I really started to build the concept of the book to when I finished the first draft. So it's even the time of the pregnancy was comparable. The last one was a fast one. I was so accelerated in my thinking that happened pretty quickly. So I don't know. I'm right now, what I'm doing is that writing energy I have is satisfied by writing a daily blog called Wisdom Well. that's out there in the world. And that's a blog about how do you actually cultivate and harvest your wisdom. And I love that. I love the idea of writing a short blog post each morning, although I actually usually do a lot of them, you know, in advance, as just a way for people to have a little microdose or snack of wisdom to start their day.
Yeah, I love your blog. And I notice every now and then you have some guest posts as well.
We do. Love to have one from you.
That wasn't like my way of I'd be honored, but that wasn't my, I was just, yeah, I hope you know that wasn't my way of.
Honestly, as I told you, your Scientific American article just like blew me away. It's like Arthur Brooks' article from The Atlantic from last June blew me away. And so Arthur and I just did a Q&A on ours. So I'd love to have you write something, or we can do a Q&A or whatever. What I know is that the thing that's interesting, Scott, is we don't really have a culture in the work world or otherwise that is vested in the idea of cultivating and harvesting wisdom. And what I mean by that, it's not that we don't have a culture of knowledge. In fact, you know, Peter Drucker is the one who came up with the phrase knowledge worker in 1959. He said the future of business will actually be ruled by knowledge workers. And here we are 61 years later, and 7 of the 10 most valuable companies in the world today are, in fact, tech companies. But what I really believe is that we've moved from a time where we need to retire the concept of the knowledge worker, because everybody has an iPhone in their pocket, and an increasing percentage of the population is what we might call knowledge workers. But I think when we're awash in knowledge, what we really have scarcity for is wisdom. And I think it's time for us to actually think about what would a wisdom worker be? And I know that sounds bizarre, but it's an interesting idea, because wisdom, this really speaks to a lot of what you've written about in your new book. A lot of it really speaks to this idea of wisdom is about pattern recognition. It's being able to assimilate and cultivate some of the patterns you've seen in your life, and then almost develop the intuition such that you can see the future even before it happens. And I don't think that there's necessarily a direct correlation between wisdom and age. I think someone can cultivate their wisdom at a very young age, or be 75 years old and have cultivated no wisdom. But what's interesting to me is, how do we create a world where the future is partially defined by wisdom workers who are able to also understand emotional intelligence and understand people? Because one of the things that computers, artificial intelligence, will get better and better and better at data and knowledge, and maybe even providing some insight. But understanding humans, artificial intelligence will get there. But, you know, trying to understand creativity or intuition, or you know, Google's great at serving up all the answers in the world, but not so great at serving up questions. And a wise person like Socrates, we should have a Socratic CEO out there in the world who is the embodiment of catalytic questions. And I think that will more and more be how we see business in the future.
Hi, everyone. I'm excited to announce that for the first time ever, I'm taking my Columbia University course online. Starting September 5th, my 8-week online course will help you live a more fulfilling, meaningful, creative, and self-actualized life. Deeply grounded in the core principles of humanistic and positive psychology, the course will help you in your own personal journey to realize your greatest strengths and become more fully human, accepting and becoming flexible with the totality of who you are so that you can become the person you most want to become. Save your spot today by going to transcendcourse.com. That's transcendcourse.com. Save your spot today and join us. It's going to be really exciting, and I'm really looking forward to getting to know folks and helping them realize their full potential. Okay, now back to the show. Wow, there's a lot of rich stuff in what you just said. Especially, I've been interested in implicit learning, and it's amazing we have these built-in systems to learn lots of patterns underneath the level of awareness. And I found in my doctoral dissertation that implicit learning, that unconscious kind of knowledge or ability, is uncorrelated with IQ. So you can be like the smartest person in the world based on an IQ test and not have that pattern detection ability just as high. So I found that really interesting.
Is that another way of saying intuition, is, or is that different, implicit?
I think it's a part of the intuitive system. It's like, we call it like one part of the system. It's really good at learning probabilities of things in our environment. Like, you know, in our social environment, we're constantly, we have this feeling like, oh, I don't think I like this person, or I really like this person. It's, you know, interesting to see what goes into that feeling. You know, what is that based on? And our unconscious system takes this whole holistic view based on lots and lots of different probabilities.
What do you think is the correlation between, say, wisdom and intuition? This is one of the things I want to write a blog post on, and it's been really hard to actually look at academic white papers on the subject. I haven't seen a lot.
You know, it's a really good question, and, you know, people in the psychological literature may disagree on that. Some people may think wisdom is actually transcending your intuition in a sense that you can rationally and consciously move beyond how you feel about something to really see it as objectively as possible. You know, there's some people who might see the emotion or the intuitive part of it as clouding your perception of reality. And then there's others who, you know, surprisingly enough, they're intuition researchers like Gary Klein, others who probably would say there's a lot of wisdom to our intuition. You know, there's in some ways it's better to listen to your intuition under a certain context. So Giger Renzer probably would argue that as well. Maybe it depends on the context, depends on how much expertise you have for something. So if I want to be wise about something that I know nothing about, maybe I don't want to rely on my intuition. But if I want to be wise about something that I've thought an awful lot about and I've experienced a lot, maybe it's actually would be wiser to listen to my intuition.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. I'm going to let you, you're in charge of this, but let's talk about Maslow at some point.
Oh, are you kidding? Like, we're definitely going to talk about Maslow. But before we jump into Maslow, that's a big topic. I want to talk a little about Phil Pizzo's research and how it's influenced you. Because when you were talking about wisdom, you know, while we're still on the topic of wisdom, I wondered how his three pillars of purpose, community, and wellness and the intersection of them relate to wisdom in midlife.
Yes. So huge fan of Dr. Phil Pizzo, formerly ran the Stanford Medical Center. And then as sort of an encore career for himself, late in his career, he chose to create the Stanford Distinguished Careers Institute. And in his research there over the last almost a decade, has come to realize that the three pillars that define later life, that a healthy later life, are purpose, community, and wellness. And if you see, frankly, the research that's been done on retirement, what you often see is that when someone retires, one of the challenges they have in retirement is they lose a sense of purpose. They lose a sense of community because work was their community. And often they lose a sense of wellness. Not because it's sort of, that was the one that was confusing to me. The reason they lose the wellness is partly because they lose the structure and the discipline of work. And therefore, everything in their life gets a little bit less disciplined, and including their health. So those are the three pillars that define the Stanford DCI program. Well, as we created, as I wrote my book and then decided to create this Modern Elder Academy as the first midlife wisdom school, we looked at almost like a Venn diagram of Phil's work and thought about what happens in the spaces between, for example, between community and purpose, or actually, let me think about it, between community and wellness. So community and wellness, if you take those two and sort of create a Venn diagram, it's social wellness. And so social wellness is a pretty important subject. It's gotten a lot of attention in the last 5 or 10 years, the subject of loneliness, the subject of people feeling dislocated, you know, bowling alone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's been a lot written on this. And one of the things that's interesting, especially for late people and later in life, is how do we move the idea of wellness to something that you do personally to something that you do collectively? You know, it's interesting that the word wellness, I'm sorry, the word illness starts with an I, the word wellness starts with a we. And so social wellness is a very important part of later life. If you look at the blue zones, look at the kinds of studies that have shown why do people live longer, you know, the George Valiant study from Harvard really does speak to this idea of community, but it's the wellness component to that. take community and you mix it with purpose and you get generativity. The Eric Erickson premise, who said as a developmental psychologist that I am what survives me, and the later stages of life is a question between generativity and stagnation. So generativity is about giving back, and it's about actually connecting your purpose to something for the community and often giving to younger people. And then the interstitial space between purpose and wellness is flourishing, highlight Marty Seligman's work. Because, you know, purpose and wellness, that interstitial intersecting space there isn't just about, you know, flourishing as a physical being. It's flourishing in your sense of being on this planet and why you're here and your sense of purpose. And, you know, to use the a Maslow perspective, it's about being self-actualized. And so what we tend to look at, loving Phil's work and DCI's work, is those three interstitial spaces. Again, social wellness, generativity, and flourishing.
Oh, boy, I love that. And you really, you bake that into your mission of the Modern Elder Academy. I'm going to read this. It's the world's first midlife wisdom school dedicated to helping people navigate midlife transitions, practice mindfulness, reframe their mindset on aging, and re-enter the workforce, dedicated to enhancing intergenerational collaboration in an era when, for the first time, we have five generations in the workplace. So there's a lot going on over there in the Modern Elder Academy.
Yeah, you know, the origin of it was I had my 4 years of full-time work at Airbnb, and then for 3.5 years now I've been a strategic advisor. Back in 2017, when I started to write the book, I had a home here on the beach in Baja, about an hour north of Cabo San Lucas on the Pacific Ocean. And I came back from a run on the beach one day, and I just asked myself, why is it I've been talking to so many, interviewing so many people in midlife, and I hear people feeling irrelevant and bewildered? And we know that the suicide rate for people 45 to 65 has actually increased by 50% in the last 20 years. So what is it? What is it? What's missing here? And a friend of mine who's a gerontologist said, you know, what's missing is we haven't as a society accepted that there's an era of life, and it's not just midlife, but it's middle essence. So middle essence is sort of like the adult corollary to adolescence. In adolescence, when you're in your teen years, you are in a transition liminal space between childhood and adulthood, and you're going through emotional and hormonal and physical changes. Similarly, if you're in your late 40s or in your 50s, you're going through emotional, hormonal, and physical changes. And frankly, I think that, as Carl Jung would say, you're going through a primary operating system change from your ego to your soul. And in that process, we have absolutely nothing in the way of public policy, government spending, or even sort of social understanding, or schools or tools, for that matter, that help people in that era of, you know, the core of midlife. And so knowing that we don't have rites of passage, rituals, or anything like that for people in this era, and people going through all kinds of transitions during this era, we decided to create a beta version of Modern Elder Academy down here. And that was early 2018. And then we opened to the public in fall of 2018, and we've now had almost 800 people from 24 countries come through the program. It's a social enterprise, so over 60% of the people have been on some form of scholarship we've given them, because we believe that wisdom isn't taught, it's shared. And it's been a fascinating experience. I mean, I really appreciate that after being a for-profit entrepreneur as a boutique hotelier with Joie de Vivre, and then in home sharing with Airbnb, that I'm a social entrepreneur. I don't make any money from this. I built the campus, but I just love the fact that we're helping people find their sense of self-actualization and transformation at an era in people's lives where a lot of people feel stuck. The U-curve of happiness data does show that people tend to bottom out with their happiness and life satisfaction around 45 to 50 or 52. But actually it shows that people get happier with each passing decade after that. And yet, and Becca Levy's work from Yale has shown that you help people to re-shift their mind, or create a mind shift on aging, and you add 7.5 years to their life. But we have very little in the way of mainstream programs, schools, and tools to help people with this. And that's really my mission in life today.
It's a beautiful mission. I guess more selfishly, I have a question about how long do I have to wait to come to this beautiful beachfront property in Mexico?
Well, I'd love to have you come teach with me down here. But let's see. Of course, with the pandemic, we're closed until October. But we have our October through July calendar, academic calendar in place. And we have all kinds of really interesting people and very interesting subjects. So our average workshop has about 18 people in it. It's a week, usually a week long, although we have some 5-day programs as well. And it's really easy to get to. Los Cabos Airport is just an hour from us. There's something called NPS, Net Promoter Score. It's a way of evaluating customer satisfaction. And you know, about 97 or 98% of our 750 to 800 people who've gone to the program have given us the highest scores, a 9 or a 10 on a 1 to 10 scale. So it's really clear we've tapped into something. We like to call it long life learning. We've heard of lifelong learning, but long life learning is a slight shift on that. It says, yes, you're going to lifelong learn, but the kind of learning that you need to do in midlife and later is to understand how to live a life as deep as it is long and understand the stages of life you're going through. And so in many ways, that's what we help people to do, is to shift their mindset on aging and really, you know, tap into that Carol Dweck concept of a growth mindset.
It sounds really, really awesome. And I'm so glad you're shining a spotlight on this, because you don't see this spotlight shined much these days, especially in this time of COVID. And you're probably seeing a lot of older people are even more lonely than even they were before, right?
So because we had to close mid-March, we have yet to sort of, we have not had a cohort here in 2.5 months. But what we do have is we have, hundreds of alums. And so what we have heard from them is they absolutely want to stay connected. And so when a cohort leaves on a Sunday, they stay connected by Zoom for, you know, weeks, months, and sometimes years to come. But what we've seen more so is a desire for a weekly speaker. So we have a mastery hour every week with speakers coming in to talk to our alums about various subjects that relate to midlife and aging. And frankly, it's not only about midlife. It's or aging. It's sometimes it relates to, you know, your relationship with money. We had Lynn Twist last week talk about the soul of money. And that's relevant to anybody at any age.
Well, that's interesting. The soul of money?
Here's a good question.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you, Scott. If you and money were to go to therapy together and, you know, you could say something about money and money could say something about you because you have a long-term relationship with money, what would you say about each other? And this really gets to the question of, you know, what is our relationship with money? What's the money script that we were born with or brought up with? And how does it influence how we operate in the world? Does money give you freedom or does it take it away? And this is one of the questions we ask later in the week during our core curriculum programs, because in many ways, money is a subject that's relevant at any age. But it's particularly relevant in midlife and beyond, because for some people, one of the things that really has them hit bottom in midlife is the sense that they've not been successful. And the question then becomes, so what are the metrics you're using for defining success? And for so many people, it relates to money. And especially in times like these, where, you know, in a Maslowian way, we're all moving to the bottom of the pyramid in our survival needs when we're in fear, especially around financial fear. So part of what we help people to do, and what Lynn definitely helps people to do with the soul of money, is to see money as a currency. And a currency is like an electric current. It's something that is something that's an energy and something that actually can be a translator for what you're looking for in your life. So to use it purely as a notch on your belt or on the wall of meeting some goal is such a limiting way to think of money. But instead, you know, money can actually be something that actually buys you freedom. But for so many people, because of the hedonic treadmill and our natural tendency to, once you've gotten one thing, you want something bigger or better, we actually end up using money as a gauge for self-worth. And You know, it's a big subject, and it's a big subject in midlife because, frankly, in midlife, it's a really important time for a lot of people. So let's say 45, 50, 55, our average age of people in the program is 54, but we've had people as young as 38 and as old as 88 in the program. But in your early 50s, you're at a stage where you're sort of like, okay, what is it that I want in my life? And in many cases, you've sort of worn through all of the expectations that you're trying to build for other people. And it's now time to sort of ask some bigger questions about what it is that you want in your life. And for a lot of people, they end up pivoting back to their historical money script. And they find that money script isn't serving them.
Or that, you know, a lot of other scripts are probably not serving them.
Oh, we have a mindset exercise. We call it the Great Midlife Edit. And in the first 24 hours, it's all about, okay, if the first half of your life is about accumulating and the second half of your life is about editing, what are you going to edit this week? What is it that is no longer serving you? What is it that you need to evolve out of?
I love that. And people can start doing that even before midlife.
For sure.
Can I get a head start?
Listen, I think the idea of cultivating and harvesting wisdom is something you can do. I started at age 26 when I started my hotel company. I created a wisdom book. And every weekend, at the end of a week, having gotten beaten up as a young entrepreneur who didn't know what the heck he was doing, I would go to my wisdom book. And it wasn't a personal journal, like writing in prose. I would just write 3, 4, 5, 6 bullet points of what I learned that week. And I did that every weekend. And I now have like 9 wisdom books over the course of 34 years. And these are just personal for me. And I go back to look at them when I'm going through a comparable time. So when we went through the Great Recession, I went back and looked at my .com bust 9/11 period wisdom book to say, were there some things I learned back then that might be helpful to me now? So yes, you don't have to be someone later in life to start looking at cultivating and harvesting your wisdom. You can do it throughout a lifetime.
So let's pivot to your book, Peak, for a second, or for more than 1 second, for the rest of this podcast episode. You talk about how Peak is the most meaningful book to you personally, and you think it's very relevant at this particular time in our challenging economy. Can you maybe outline, first of all, what inspired you to write this book?
Thank you. I can't wait to spend more time in person with you to talk about all
me
this
too.
Stuff. So Maslow was always interesting to me. I only took one psychology class in college, and yet the one class I took with Phil Zimbardo at Stanford was, you know, psychology 1, and I just remembered Maslow. Maslow was the good guy. All the other psychologists seemed to be focused on worst practices in human behavior, and Maslow was focused on best practices, and that's what ultimately led to his hierarchy of needs, with the basic premise being that you have these basic needs, and then as you move up from these survival needs to your success needs, which might be your social belonging needs and your esteem needs, and then you get to these transformational needs at the top, which is self-actualization. Well, when my company hit the skids in the .com bust in 9/11, my boutique hotel company, I went to a local library looking for a business book that was going to help me get through a difficult time as the CEO. And quickly, I ended up moving over to the self-help section of the bookstore because I realized my problems were more than just business. And that's when I saw some of Maslow's books. And I decided that I wanted to read, you know, some of his books. And so I did. And then I asked the question of my senior leaders about, you know, a month into reading these books. Well, if Maslow was really about how to create self-actualization for individuals, how could we create a self-actualized company? Because our company is just full of individuals. And what I started to learn about Maslow is later in his life, in his last 8 to 10 years, he was really studying how his hierarchy of needs could be applied to the collective or towards organizations. He was working in companies, and not many people knew that. What this led me to is like saying, okay, well, what if we were to translate the 5 levels of Maslow's pyramid into a simple 3-level pyramid? Survival at the base, success in the middle, and transform at the top. And then we applied that 3-level transformation pyramid to employees, customers, and investors. And long story short is, you know, one of the beautiful things about being both a writer and an operator as a business person is I can actually have a living laboratory to see if it works. And so between 2001 and 2005, we studied whether this peak model, where we helped people address their survival needs, whether they're employees, customers, or investors, move them up to their success needs and then move them up to transformation needs, did it work? And what we found is that in the downturn, when we were using this peak model, that 80% of our hotels gained market share in the dot-com bust 9/11 downturn, which is really unusual because usually it's just the chain hotels that succeed in a downturn. So we ultimately taught everybody in our company, 3,500 employees, the model. And then I was starting to give speeches about it. And that's what led me to write the book, Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. And
I love that. I love the title.
Yeah, well, Mojo and Maslow, I mean, there really is. And what I started to find was that there are a lot of companies that had used Maslow's hierarchy of needs in their employer customer thinking, whether it was Southwest Airlines or Whole Foods Markets or Harley Davidson, or later after my book came out, Zappos, Tony Hsieh. So it was really fascinating to see that Maslow had a bigger impact in the business world than most people knew. But no one had actually written a book on Maslow applied to business before Peak came out.
Yeah, besides Maslow himself. That was a long time ago.
Your psyche and management, which, you know, sold 3,000 copies. And then Deborah Stevens really popularized it with the Maslow Business Reader and Maslow on Management. But to be honest with you, they were quite academic in terms of their focus. They were not really written for the business audience so much.
Yeah, no, you did an incredible service to the world. So I want to zoom in because you have pyramids upon pyramids here. So you have an employee pyramid, you have a customer pyramid, and then you have an investor pyramid. And would you mind if we walked our listeners through each one of those three pyramids so they can see like what is the highest aspiration for each of these concepts?
So again, with the transformation pyramid as the model, survival at the base, success in the middle, and transform at the top, the employee pyramid is money or the compensation package at the base. The middle is recognition, and the top is meaning. So money, recognition, meaning. And interestingly enough, it lines up with job, career, calling. So when someone has a calling, they often feel like they have a straight meaning in their work. When someone has a job, they tend to be focused on their compensation package. And when they're focused on their career, they're focused on being recognized in what they're doing and having a career path. So what this helped us to see is that, in fact, stats on this are very, very, very conclusive. The fourth most likely reason a person leaves their job in the United States is because of money. It's not the predominant reason. And so it's a base. Money and compensation package is a really important thing you need to stabilize, especially in a downturn, and job security and perks and things like that. But it's not the reason most people leave their job. The reason most people leave their job goes to the second level of recognition. The number one reason people leave their job is because of their boss. And so recognition starts with your boss, but it goes beyond that. It goes to how do people in the organization recognize you and appreciate you? Is there a career path that gives you the sense that you're recognized for your growing value to the business? Is there a learning and development program around that? And so that also, but those first two things are sort of like bartering things. They're, you know, if the company gives you money and recognition, you will give, you know, a lot in return. What happens at the third level of it, which is meaning, is you move from extrinsic motivation to intrinsic motivation. And when a company can do that and help create an environment where people feel a deep sense of meaning in what the company does, you know, at the organization and in what they do to support that noble purpose, it's huge. And that is what great companies do, is they help people move up that pyramid to that state of being inspired by the meaning and also feeling a sense of calling.
Yeah. And you also talk about loyalty, feeling a sense of loyalty to the company. Love that. Also, I just love inspiration as a goal among your employees. You don't often see that in every company where that's like their bottom line is not always inspiration.
Yeah.
You write, unfortunately, in a serious downturn, most companies get fixated at the bottom of the pyramid and don't look at the ways they can create recognition or meaning for their companies. Do you think within the context of COVID, this is even more relevant? I mean, it seems so.
You know, when we hit bad times, people move to anxiety and then to survival. And so even if you're a company that has, you know, developed a peak model, a lot of people get nervous. And when people get nervous, they move down to the survival needs. What that tends to do in their brain in terms of their operating philosophy is it means that they're less creative. It means that they're less focused on being curious. They tend to get more focused on, you know, how do we survive this? That's fine. In the short run, I think it's an absolutely smart thing to do. The problem is they get stuck there. And the reality is that if you get stuck at the bottom of any of these three pyramids, the money, the employee, the customer, or the investor one, you over time just become a commodity. You have not differentiated yourself nor created loyalty. And great business and great organizations that are models do not do that because they're at the commodity survival level of the pyramid. So the key is, you know, for us back in the day in the dot-com bust, we had to secure, what we wanted to say to our employees, and this, we were the only hotel company in the Bay Area that did this, we are not going to lay you off due to economic reasons. If you're not doing your job well, we promise you we'll give you warning and you'll get performance reviews along the way. And progressive discipline, if needed, I hate that term, progressive discipline. Sounds like you're talking to children. But the idea is you will not lose your job in this economic downturn. Now, in order for us to do that, we had to, number one, be open to having a slightly lower profit margin than our competitors. And number two is all of our senior leaders took 10 and 20% pay cuts. I did a salary sabbatical for 3.5 years. We moved all of our employees over to Kaiser, which was a much more affordable health insurance plan. If people wanted to do a PPO instead of an HMO, they could pay extra for that. But we wanted to actually make a major cut in our expenses. So we did a bunch of things in order to create people's sense of safety. And if you have a sense of safety in your work and you're not going to walk into work one day and realize you've lost your job, people then can move up to the next level of the pyramid. But when people are in turmoil and in anxiety, they tend to get stuck at the bottom of the pyramid.
So true. And Maslow definitely pointed that out a lot, the deficiency motivation, The derealm of existence.
That's right.
Okay, so let's talk about the customer pyramid now. What are the needs that you differentiate within the customer pyramid?
So the customer pyramid is it's relevant across whether you're a defense contractor or a dry cleaner. There are three levels. The survival level is meet my expectations. That's what the customers want. The success level is meet my desires. It's one level higher. And the peak of this pyramid is to meet the unrecognized needs of the customer. So any company in a downturn is going to try to do its best to benchmark itself versus its competitors. What's your level of customer satisfaction? But often what's at the base of the pyramid is the commodity. It's what a person as a customer expects from you. And if you don't even deliver on that, you don't even get onto this pyramid at all. There's very little loyalty there, unless you're in like some kind of governmental regulated industry, or, you know, you're in some kind of business where there you can't have new competitors. But in the era of the internet, which is, we're about 25 years into it now, the customer has become more promiscuous, which means the customer has more choices. And if the customer has more choices and all you're doing is meeting expectations, the customer will start looking for other options that actually take them to the next level of the pyramid, meeting their desires. And it's a very subtle change from expectations to desires. And it requires you to be really close to your customers. And this is where focus groups and things like that can be very helpful. But the third level of this pyramid is altogether different. Steve Jobs was quite famous at Apple for saying focus groups tell us nothing because customers need to see what it is we're creating in order to understand it. And so at the top of the pyramid, it really means you're going to be creating something that your customers hadn't even thought of. This is why we call it meeting the unrecognized needs. And that's what creates the transformation. So Apple was spectacular at creating products that were not created by the customer. You know, if you think about the iPod long ago,
yeah,
it was a Sony Walkman, but made digitally. And the idea of being able to have mobile music, but it was a whole different product. No customer was ever going to create that. But Apple could feel like, okay, this is what customers wanted. When I created one of my hotels in San Francisco called the Hotel Vitale, this was 20 years ago, I could see that yoga was a growing part of the business traveler's life, but you didn't have a yoga studio in your hotel. And if you're staying in a financial district, of course you didn't. Maybe if you're in a spa hotel, you did, but not in a business class hotel. So we put a yoga studio on the penthouse level of a first class business hotel, and everybody looked at me like, "What the heck are you doing? That's like you're putting your best real estate for a yoga class with great views of the bay and an outdoor area." And I said, "Yeah, because I want the theme of this hotel to be all about helping people to feel like they can be healthy while they're on the road." Now today that makes a ton of sense, but 20 years ago that was an unfathomable idea, and it was an unrecognized need of our customer. No customer had ever asked for it. But the moment we actually launched that hotel with that free yoga class every morning in the penthouse, it became a huge hit. And the Wall Street Journal and, you know, LA Times and other newspapers wrote about it. And it became, in many ways, the brand of the hotel. So long story short is, I mean, trying to understand the unrecognized needs of your customers requires that you're a bit of a mind reader. You better understand both your customers really well, but also the aspirations of what they wish you're delivering to them that they almost didn't feel like was a possibility. I mean, it's like Wi-Fi in the air 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, you know, business traveler, you wanted Wi-Fi in the air, but just like wasn't even available. But here's the other thing about this pyramid is once you give Wi-Fi in the air, which is an unrecognized need, within 2 years, it goes from unrecognized need to desire to expectation. And when you don't get your Wi-Fi in the air, I hope you're listening to United Airlines, and you're constantly like not getting your Wi-Fi in the air, all of a sudden what was an unrecognized need has become an expectation, and then you get upset as a customer.
That's for sure. Well, since Jobs passing, I'm trying to think if Apple has put out anything that we didn't realize we needed. I can't think of anything, and I wonder what the future of Apple will be in that regard.
That's a good question. I mean, you know, he had such an intuitive sense of humans. I mean, I think Johnny Ive was a beautiful designer of that vision, but it's a real question. It's a real being able to, out of thin air, imagine what people want is an exceptional gift. The good news is there are companies like IDEO that are design thinkers who help companies like Apple and others to imagine products that don't exist today. So I don't think it requires the heroic CEO entrepreneur of like a Steve Jobs to do that. I think it can be a collective effort as well.
Hey everyone, if you find the themes we cover on the Psychology Podcast interesting and enlightening, you might be interested in my new book, Transcend: The New Science of Self-Actualization. The book is the culmination of my journey to scientifically discover the factors that can lead us to optimal health, growth, creativity, peak experiences, and deep fulfillment. I believe we can still manage to have peak experiences, the most wondrous moments that make life worth living, regardless of our current life circumstances. We can choose growth. For more, you can visit transcend-book.com. That's transcend-book.com. With a hyphen between the word transcend and the word book. If you get a chance to read the book, it'd be great if you could leave a review on Amazon, tweet about it, or share the book with friends. I truly hope this book can help people get through these tough times and realize that we all have greater resiliency, creativity, and potential within us than we ever realized. Okay, now back to the show.
I agree. And you see it all the time on Twitter. Just Steve Martin posted a video of him playing banjo in the woods, and the big headline for everyone who was sharing on Twitter was like, "This is the video I didn't even know I needed to watch." So I think just in the age of social media, just people just on TikTok or all these different ways that everyday people, you don't have to be a Steve Jobs or Steve Martin, you can produce content that is so strange and creative that people are like, "Wow, I didn't know I needed to see this today to uplift me." You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Let's move on to the investor pyramid. How about that? You said that one was the most surprising to you. Is that right?
it was very surprising, primarily because, like, you know, we know that employees are humans. We know that customers are humans. So the hierarchy of needs of humans made sense. But are investors human? and would they have a hierarchy of needs? And I came to realize, yes. And after interviewing a lot of them, and I had a lot of investors, you know, in my company. So the base of this pyramid, the survival need, is a transactional alignment, which just basically means that you have a common definition of what the business is and what it's trying to accomplish. And quite frankly, in a lot of cases, most companies, not most, but many companies, especially entrepreneurs and investors, don't even have the base of this pyramid right. The next level of the pyramid, the success level, is like what Warren Buffett does. It's a relationship. It's relationship alignment. Buffett says to his CEOs of the companies he invests in or buys, I want you to operate as if you're going to be here 100 years from now. So instead of sort of seeing as everything's transactionally based and short-term oriented in terms of returns, Buffett has a long-term perspective based upon building a relationship. And then finally, the third level, the transformational level, is a legacy investor or a mission-aligned investor. And these are people who put their money where their heart is, and they tend to invest in something because they either want to do something socially responsible for their community or for the world. They want to invest in someone they care about, like their daughter or son who's creating a clothing business, or even someone like Peter Thiel, who, you know, doesn't necessarily give people the warm and fuzzy sometimes. Peter Thiel is a legacy investor because in many ways, his intent is to disrupt industries. And that's, you could say, okay, well, that's just a person at the base of the pyramid. No, no, no. A legacy investor has a very long-term perspective. At the base of the pyramid is short-term. At the top of the pyramid is long-term. At the base of the pyramid is tangible. At the top of the pyramid is intangible. This is true of all three pyramids. And so Peter Thiel is, in fact, interested in investing in a company like Airbnb that's going to disrupt hospitality. Not because he necessarily is doing it for a social good in society, although he is a big believer in the idea that disruption creates, you know, the wildfires necessary to burn down the things that need to be burned down. But he does it partly because he thinks that the world needs the constant new competition to help, you know, improve. It's sort of like somewhat of a Darwinian philosophy, which is a survival of the fittest. And it's more of a survival of the most adaptable, which is really what Darwin talked about. And I think it's really what Peter Thiel is all about.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And then in your model of the investor pyramid, a self-actualized investor is one who focuses on legacy and is mission aligned.
Correct. There's definitely a sense that the entrepreneur and the company and their investors are all aligned. And if you're not aligned, you end up in a situation where the company and the entrepreneur have a very long-term perspective on things. And then all of a sudden they realize their investors are very short-term oriented. And that can happen in a recession. I mean, it very much can. In a recession, if a company is bleeding money, has a big burn rate, and their investors say, you have to, you know, cut your burn rate and become profitable in the next year, and the company is so far from profitability, they might as well be telling the entrepreneur, close up shop. And that's where, frankly, making sure you're aligned with your investors is pretty important, because if you don't have that, you may have a great idea, but it's 3 years out and your investors are going to not give you 3 years.
That makes a lot of sense. I love how you look at this from every possible angle. You also have looked into peak leaders and what are the practices of peak leaders. You have 8 practices. What are some of your favorites? That might be a hard question to ask.
Well, I think I'll just give you 2 or 3, because it's interesting. There's 8 and they have a certain, they're chronological on some level. I mean, I think one example is you better have a positive perspective on human nature. So this is, you know, peak is very much a Maslowian perspective of, if you give people the incentive and the space to live their best work life, they will show up and be incredibly engaged. Now, that's sort of theory Y management. Theory X management has a different perspective. And frankly, it's the industrial model that goes back to Frederick Taylor. And it's all based upon the premise that, you know what? employees are basically lazy, so you better have a time clock. Otherwise, you know, you gotta watch when they arrive and when they depart. You better give incentives to them, and you know, sometimes the carrot's not the solution; it's the stick. And so, the premise of Peak is that if you create the conditions for people to live their callings and to actually be inspired by the purpose of the company, you will get more engagement out of them. Most of us now believe that. But honestly, when I first started to talk about this stuff 15 or 20 years ago, there were a lot of people who didn't agree with me, especially in the hospitality business, which is generally a pretty hierarchical industry. What's another example? Another example I talked about in my TED talk in 2010 when I went to Bhutan and studied their gross national happiness index. And that is that generally what's at the base of the pyramid is tangible and easily benchmarkable. For example, companies have compensation surveys where they competitively benchmark themselves versus other companies. And therefore, they can sort of see how they're doing. But no companies have a benchmark for meaning and like what's at the peak of the employee pyramid. But there's lots of ways in a customer satisfaction survey with your employees where you could actually get clarity on what level of meaning your employees have in the organization. You may not be able to benchmark it versus other companies, although today you can. 5 years ago, it was harder to do that. So what a peak leader does is they realize that don't get, you know, it's very important to manage what you can measure, but don't just assume that the only things you should measure are the simplest things to measure, like, you know, profitability or compensation. But instead, look at how you measure evangelists, how many evangelists you have and how do they show up for you. How do you measure reputation? How do you measure loyalty, both employee loyalty and customer loyalty? So these are all, I think, very important things. And I could go on and on, but I'm going to leave it at that just to say those are two of the eight peak practices.
Thank you. You write peak leaders believe humans are basically good, and you mentioned that earlier. And that's also similar to this this light triad scale that we're developing to be counteract the dark triad in the scientific literature. And this, and one of the key components of we call them everyday saints, is that they believe that humans are fundamentally good. So yeah. I love that. That also is a good for a leader. Have you come across in your readings Maslow's theory Z?
Yes.
How does that go beyond theory Y? I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, and you tell me, Scott, and I love getting schooled. I was lucky enough. I have Maslow's diaries for the last 10 years of his life. There are 100 volumes out there, and his family gave me a two volume set, which is where I saw him write a little bit more about theory Z. Although he did in New Psyche Management as well. My impression of theory Z is when it actually is moving towards sort of the transcendence level of something that's beyond just what's good for the company, what's good for the human. It has a bigger purpose attached to it. But am I correct in that, or am I off?
I think you're right. There's theory Z. He called them the transcenders. Were motivated, consistently motivated by the B values, the values of being itself, things like goodness. So you could just call them higher values, more colloquially, more spiritual values, things that transcend oneself, truth, beauty, meaningfulness, goodness, justice. And we're also motivated by peak experiences. It was an important part of their day and at work. They want to be in that kind of flow state or be deeply absorbed in what they're doing, but also feel like a great connection to humanity more generally.
I think what a lot of people don't know about Maslow, you know, gets beaten up a lot, especially in academia.
Not cool.
Maslow's perceived as like an old school thing, and you know, and it's perceived as sort of Western society, and it, you know, and very self absorbed, very 1970s, you know, the me generation. But you know, later in life, Maslow added a sixth, seventh, and I think an eighth level. And I know that two of those three levels are beauty or aesthetics and transcendence, self transcendence at the top. And in many ways, you know, Maslow has somehow got a little bit besmirched by the fact that in an era, the 1960s and 70s, when there was a sort of counter-revolution against tradition in all forms, including in psychology, that people sort of thought of Maslow as just a hippie. And He was nothing like a hippie. Yes, yeah. He hung out at the Institute in Big Sur. And yes, he was fascinated by a lot of different ways, including Native American ways of building community and what were the hierarchy of needs for Native Americans. But he really did believe that at the end of the day, these transcenders were people who actually transcended their own self-actualization. They were doing something that allowed them to almost create social actualization, something higher than a self-actualization. And in his case, he just called it transcendence.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't know that. And also, he even went beyond the peak experience to talk about the plateau experience. I was wondering how much did you come across the plateau experience in your readings?
Tell us about it.
Towards the last couple of years of his life, when he was facing his own mortality, he realized his life was not so full of these peak experiences, these one-off momentous feelings of ecstasy, but something more measured and sustainable throughout the day, where he would see the miraculous in the everyday. He said it's like lounging in heaven, not getting so excited about it.
You know, I call this spying on the divine.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
I go out and I actually now have 3 segments a week, about 3 hours each time, 3 to 4, 5 hours. Living in nature here, where a lot of people don't know that the Baja Peninsula that starts at San Diego goes all the way down to Cabo San Lucas. We have actually more coastline than California plus Florida combined. We have just under what Florida and California have combined. We have almost no people on the beaches. So I love going for a drive in the desert, or go to a beach, or go to a little tropical forest here, and then just spend an hour or two or three just observing. Sometimes I'll take a picture, and post on Instagram, but rarely. I'm just doing it for the sake of observing, because that spying on the divine, that sense of being at one with, it's like being in cathedral. It's like being in church.
Absolutely. I'm getting chills as you talk about this. I love that phrase, spying on the divine. It's beautiful. And Maslow would love it, I think. So think about the pyramid is interesting, because I never actually found him draw it. He never drew a pyramid.
Yes.
And if you trace back, as some researchers have in the business world, to who created the pyramid? It looks like one of the earliest pictures was of a stepladder with like the man at the top with a flagpole as self-realized.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's part of those, for those of us who are like Maslowians, and we should have like an annual conference.
Oh, we totally should.
Almost like UFO people.
Yeah.
Because people are like Maslow is a complete religion to them. I've read a lot of different articles about this. And of course, I never met him because he died when I was 10 years old. But what is clear to me is that he did see the way that the pyramid is drawn now is written. It looks like it's quite literal, that you have to actually finish a level before you go to the next level. And what he was very clear is that once a person hits 50, 60, 70% of that first level, this new need pops up at the next level. And then another one pops up. But he didn't write a lot about the following thing, though, that I think is really interesting, is, if you're a monk and you live in the Himalayas and your life is basically getting your basic needs met, but you're just going straight to the top of that pyramid. I think you can absolutely transcend some of the middle levels. And he didn't talk a ton about that from my experience. He didn't write a lot about that. But I do think the idea that there's some literal, you have to meet 100% and then meet 100% at the next level is silly. And I don't, he never said anything about that. And you're right that he never even had an actual pyramid.
Yeah, I'm glad that we can nerd out at this level of specificity. There's it's a book of Maslow's unpublished essays. I don't know if you came across that in your research, where he has an article in there, an essay that's never been published, called "Can Monks Ever Self-Actualize?" Where he writes his thoughts on that. And I think he comes to the conclusion, if I remember correctly, and I can try to find it and share it with you, but I think he comes to the conclusion that they can't be. That if you isolate yourself from the world and you don't have that connection and it's all internal in your head, then you cannot become fully human. I remember reading that. I was like, damn, like, you're kind of like hating on monks a bit there, Maslow. But I thought it was a very interesting essay.
Yeah.
I really appreciate your time. I wanted to just end our chat today with a really funny video and an elucidating video at the same time, where you talk about some existential questions to ask yourself during a downturn. And I thought this would be a great place to end because it can really help people during this time. And I also love this machine. I want to know where you can get this machine where you can balance yourself.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember the exact five questions I asked there, but I think I'll give you like two or three. It's an inversion machine that allows you to turn upside down. And I do it every morning. And it's not just good for your back, but it's actually sort of everything in your body sort of gets used to the idea of like being on the other side. What I think we need to ask ourselves in a crazy time like this is some profound questions like, wow, if I were to live just five more years, how would I want to spend those 5 years? I'm not a big fan of saying just a month because most of us are not going to live just another month. But 5 years is a provocative number because it allows you to actually be productive and focus some of your time on work. A lot of people, if it's just a month, they just say, I would never work again. But that's not necessarily a solution. But creating a little bit of a sense of urgency about what is important to you and getting clear on that's really important. One of the other questions I like to ask myself and that we've really taught here at MEA is ask yourself what you know now that you wish you'd known 10 years ago. And there's a lot of things. Like I wish I'd learned Spanish 10 years ago. I'm now learning it now. I wish I'd learned to surf 10 years ago. I'm now learning it now. So then ask yourself the question based upon that sort of foundation. What is it that 10 years from now you wish you'd learned now that would serve you 10 years from now? And that's a really great way of trying to help you understand what are the paths toward learning things that are going to serve you in the future that you might put off now, but that actually by learning them now are going to actually accelerate your process. Like, I don't want to learn how to surf at 69 years old. I'm 59. I don't want to learn Spanish at 69. I want to learn it at 59. How else could you apply that? So people are welcome to actually see my videos and my blog posts at WisdomWell. And because I think everybody, nurturing yourself with a little piece of wisdom every morning is not a bad way to cultivating and harvesting your own wisdom.
Oh, I agree. And then I love this one. Can you write an obituary you can live with?
Oh, yeah.
What's your legacy? Do it in 280 characters so it's concise and even tweetable. And I believe that at that point in this video, a bird tweets.
Yes. Wow. Dude, I'm very impressed. Yeah, that's very weird that it just happened, like, you know, serendipity. But yeah. David Brooks has written a lot about eulogy and the values of eulogy, the values of resume and the virtues. And, you know, I think more and more of us need to be asking the question of what we want said at our eulogy.
I love it. Well, Chip, I really appreciate you talking to me today and think what you're putting out there in the world is so beautiful and important. And it's great to have a kindred spirit that we can bond over our nerdy love for Maslow.
Well, Scott, we're gonna spend more time together. We're gonna figure out how we're gonna get you down here to the academy. Maybe have you write a blog post on Wisdom Well, or have me do a Q&A with you. And I'm excited to read your book. I haven't gotten a chance to read it yet because it's actually sitting in San Francisco for me. So,
oh, cool.
That too.
So to be continued.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in on the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. If you can, please add a rating and review on iTunes. I read all of the reviews and really appreciate your feedback. Also, for additional exclusive must-listen-to episodes, check out our new Patreon page at patreon.com/psychpodcast. That's patreon.com/psychpodcast. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.